Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Welcome to Advanced as we continue about the world's business decisions. And today, as panelists, we have
Josh,
Bill,
and Doris. So stay tuned. Well, this is quite an exciting article. I'm learning a lot of new things, aren't you, Bill?
I sure am, Doris. And actually, what this did is it spurred me into even more research about some of the business decisions. So it's a great article.
It's on page 26, 27. We talked about page 26 yesterday. What did we talk about yesterday?
Well, we're stepping inside the world's greatest business decisions. And a very famous magazine, Fortune, got all their editors together and they compiled a list of the 18 greatest business decisions of all time.
I would think that book would be a great, you know, a bestseller, because when you see a book that says the greatest business decisions of all times, wouldn't most businessmen want to buy that?
I think they would. I was a business owner for many years, and decision making is the toughest part of the job, how to react to the changes around you.
And it's interesting to find out what other people did. But these decisions that they made that we're talking about were what they call very bold decisions. They were not the usual decisions. They had to probably use a lot of money or a lot of resources. And so they were actually very bold decisions, weren't they?
And something we didn't talk about yesterday is that what drove most of these decisions was risk, about stepping out into the unknown and doing something differently than your competitors. And so that's very challenging.
That would be kind of like the innovation. To do something new is to innovate, to do something that hasn't been done before.
Right. And a couple of the words we used yesterday, counterintuitive and also went against the grain. So a lot of these risky decisions were things people weren't doing what everybody else was doing. They did something completely different and they changed the game.
So the decisions that we're going to talk about were those that actually paid off. They really worked out well. But I think there's an awful lot of bold decisions that don't pay off too.
I think that would be an even more exciting book, The 18 Worst Business Decisions of All Time.
Right.
And how to learn from major mistakes that companies have made.
Well, you might suggest that to them and see if they want to write another one, Josh.
That's right. Maybe I'll write it.
Well, let's get started today on page 27. And where are we going to start in today, Bill?
All right. Well, we're going to be there on page 27. And what we do is we had mentioned a company as far as 3M we're going to be talking about in the beginning and debunking one of the myths of business. And then we're getting into another example of a smaller company. So it's a great day.
So let's get started and read the first column.
For example, Jeff Colvin, the Fortune senior editor-at-large who writes the 3M chapter, debunks the idea that the Post-it note came entirely from the company's free time endeavor. It was 3M's culture that was truly responsible for one of its most famous products. Beating the Giants. Some of the most inspirational examples are in the book's less familiar stories. How the company that invented liquid soap was able to fend off the behemoths of the industry is a noteworthy anecdote. The brainchild of Robert Taylor, the CEO of a small Minnesota company called Minnetonka Corporation, liquid soap was the kind of small enterprise innovation that is usually immediately copied by the corporate giants on the block. And indeed, when Taylor's liquid soap started flying off the shelves, Unilever, Colgate and Procter & Gamble started testing their own versions.
Well, what's the first example we're going to talk about?
Well, we're jumping into 3M, which is a product manufacturing company based in Minnesota. And Fortune editor Jeff Colvin wrote the 3M chapter in this book, where it debunks the idea of where the Post-it note came from.
So he just says, well, the way you usually think is the way it started was not the way it started.
No, it was not from their free time endeavor that we talked about yesterday, that William McKnight, the CEO from the 40s, set aside a portion of the employee's time to innovate, to think about new things.
But that isn't where that came from, though.
No.
Well, that's what Jeff Colvin's talking about here. He debunks this idea, so it's something is not true. And the idea, there's, you know, products that take on a mythical quality or even a folklore. There's stories behind it, and actually the stories become maybe not so accurate.
That's true about all stories, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the 3M's culture, which means the company's way of doing things, was responsible for the fact that for one of its most famous products. I remember probably a year or two ago we did an article on that. I think somebody was using it to make notes that they took to church in their songbook or something like that. But it was a different story than you'd ordinarily think of anyway.
Right. And Post-it notes, as you know, are those little yellow stickies that you can write little things on. You see them all over, you know, boardrooms and people's desks and books.
I have one right by my bed at nights in case I want to write a note. Then I can stick it on something and take it to office next morning.
Right. So the mythical story is that, okay, this came by accidentally. However, what Jeff Colvin is talking about here is that it actually, okay, it appears to be an accident, but really the truth of the matter is it comes from the free time endeavor of the company at 3M. They encouraged this thinking outside the box, acting outside the box. So
we have to read the book to find out more about
right.
it, I
yeah.
guess. But there's some other ones that are giants. When we say beating the giants, well, the giants are the companies that really are the big, big companies. And sometimes the small companies think, well, you know, they're not a big company and they'll never be able to make it. So this beating the giants is a pretty interesting paragraph, don't you think?
It sure is. And I think this is where we dive into less familiar territory for me. Most of us knew about Jack Welch and about the Tylenol poisonings that Johnson & Johnson reacted to. But I did not know anything about where soft soap came from.
And that's one of the inspirational examples because they're less familiar stories, and it tells us about this company that invented liquid soap. You know, yeah. I never thought about that, Bill. You know, there was a time when we didn't have liquid soap.
Somebody invented it.
Right.
It's amazing. Everybody has this in their home, usually maybe in the bathroom or by the kitchen sink. Where did it come from? And it wasn't, you know, one of the famous companies, but it was a small company, and they were able to fend off the behemoths of the industry. A behemoth is just a giant. Normally we use that to describe like a giant animal or something.
And they could fight him off, right?
In a movie or
fend
story.
Fend him off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just figured that Colgate or Palmolive or Unilever were one of the companies that invented soft soap. Somewhere in a lab somewhere, they decided mm-hmm. that this was the product that they would roll out next. But no, it turned out it was the brainchild of Robert Taylor, the CEO of a small Minnesota company.
Right. Isn't that interesting? Called Minnetonka Corporation. And the liquid soap was just a very small enterprise. And they said that they usually these kind of things copy the corporate giants on the block. On the block just means in the same business. But that isn't what happened here. This company didn't just copy the big companies, did they?
Well, actually, it's the other way around. They actually are the one that invented it. And normally then, big companies, once they see an innovation by a small company, they aren't going to pay any rights. They're not going to respect the small company. They're just going to come in and they're just going to copy whatever the small company made. And they're going to try and put them out of business.
People do that to your magazines all the time, Bill.
They do
copy. Everybody
yeah.
copies, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If you are successful, they will copy it.
Yeah.
Imitation's the sincerest form of flattery, right?
Yeah. Right. Sometimes it's hard for the business, right? But, you know, when Taylor's liquid soap started flying off the shelf, which just mean was selling so quickly. It was like it was flying. They'd put it on the shelves and people would buy it. So that's a very good descriptive way of saying sold very quickly, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, people couldn't get enough of it. And that's when the behemoths stepped in. Unilever, Colgate, and the biggest of them all, Procter & Gamble, we call P&G sometimes, they started testing their own versions of liquid soap, meaning they put small samples of their product that was similar to Taylor's into markets and testing how well they sold.
But then they thought, well, how can they keep them from taking over the whole market? Because they are the big, big companies. And this is pretty interesting. I didn't know this either. Did you, Bill?
Well, I did not know this either. And, you know, we're going to find out a little bit more about how not only did Robert Taylor get this product established, and that what he did then afterwards to prevent the behemoths from copying him, it's really quite amazing.
It was a little-known strategy at that time to keep control of the market. In fact, it took a big investment.
That's right. It was a big risk by Taylor to fend off the giants. Let's read the last column.
Taylor, however, devised a little-known strategy to keep control of the market. He found a way to block his giant competitors from accessing the plastic pumps used in the liquid soap bottles. At the time, only one company made the pumps. Taylor met with the CEO of the company and took the financial risk of ordering 100 million pumps, effectively ensuring a monopoly of the pumps for a full year. The strategy, which had never been attempted by such a small company, worked. By the time his competitors had access to the pumps, Taylor's soft soap brand was well established. The 18 great management decisions in this book are not ranked in any particular order. They stand as inspirational examples of the power of bucking conventional wisdom and making bold and innovative decisions.
Well, Taylor really did take a big risk in here, as we've just read about, didn't he?
He certainly did. And so the competitors were coming into the space that he had created, the brainchild of liquid soap. And instead of focusing on the customer or on marketing, he focused on manufacturing.
Right. And only one company made those little pumps. I didn't even think about that. You know, we use those all the time now. So many things.
That's right. They seem like, yeah, they're spreading liquid all over the world. And he's found a way to keep his competitors from accessing the one company that made the pumps.
What did he do?
All right. Well, what he did is he met with this company. There was only one company that made the pumps. He met with the CEO. And this is really amazing. He took the financial risk of ordering 100 million pumps.
100 million?
I imagine the guy fell off his chair when he heard that order.
I know. Well, he was probably happy. Just think of that.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder how many people started making pumps after that. A lot of people.
Right? I was really surprised that only one company did that at the time.
Yeah.
And he would have had to do this right in the beginning because, okay, he's got this product that he develops. And if it starts getting successful, the big companies, Colgate, P&G.
They'll make their own pumps.
They will notice this within a month. They will notice this product is successful because they have thousands of people out in the field. They will identify this product and say, this is successful. We got to figure out how to beat this guy. So he had to do this all pretty much ahead of time. This wasn't later. He had to do this ahead of time.
You know, what I was wondering is whether this little pump thing that they use that you always push down to get the soap to come out or whatever it is, do you think that there was a patent on that or what?
There must not have been, or else.
Well, I mean, if there wasn't, then other people could make pumps.
Well, then he would have had the advantage that way, right?
Well, I think the owner of the pump company, the plastic pump company,
had the patent. That's what I mean.
Not Robert Taylor.
No, no. Well, but if somebody had to have a patent on it. Otherwise, they could make their pumps too, couldn't they?
That's right. So right. Robert Taylor invented the idea of liquid soap, but he needed help to distribute it through this mechanism.
Mm. And so the people that made the pumps must have had a patent on the pumps. Otherwise, these companies would have made their own pumps.
Right. That guy had to have a patent on it, which protected him for 17 years as far as that particular design of the pump. Now, what this did then, it effectively ensured a monopoly of the pumps for a full year to Robert Taylor. And what that means is when he had a monopoly on it, he was the only one that had control of these pumps.
And a year, probably because that's how long it would take for the pump company to make 100 million pumps.
But, you know, he could have ended up with a whole warehouse full of those pumps. If nobody bought the soap, what's he going to do with 100 million pumps? That would be, I don't know, that was a big risk, wasn't it, Bill?
Give them out for Christmas gifts? Or
I don't know what you're going to do with them.
If you didn't sell.
Right.
Yeah, it was a huge, huge gamble. Now,
do you think people thought he was crazy when he did that? Some people probably did.
He probably laid awake at night a few nights.
Worried about it.
Deciding it. Now, okay, let's say a bottle of soft soap costs a dollar, right? He's probably paying this guy maybe 5 or 10 cents a pump,
right.
At most 10 cents.
Sure, not so very much.
It's not a big cost per unit, but when you make it 100 million, then, yeah, it is a big number. So, you know, he had to decide, how do the numbers work out in all of this, and do I take a risk? He might have had, I don't know if he's independently wealthy or if he had other partners in on this.
Hard to say.
Who knows? But we could.
Well, maybe,
I think other companies have looked at the manufacturing process and tried to find competitive advantages. But it says it's never been attempted before by such a small company to take the sort of risk. So
by the time his competitors, they had access to the pumps. By the time they were allowed to do it, well, his soft soap brand was well established. So everybody said, well, this is the one that makes that. So he got well established all over the United States.
Well, so he had the pump. He had the functional way of delivering the soap. But then also, look at that name, soft soap. That name also would have been, he would have copyrighted that, which means he possessed that name. And so Colgate, Procter & Gamble, they've got to name their product something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so if within 6 months, if it's a good product, he's got that name, people will identify with it. They'll say, that's what I want.
And that's the leader, definitely. When you think of liquid soap in the States, you think soft soap. And our author sort of saved that name for later in the article. I wasn't sure at first who we were talking about when we got to know Robert Taylor. But then, yes, in line 18, we talk about the brand soft soap, which is still the market leader.
Mm-hmm. All right. Isn't that interesting? Well, it said that the 18 great management decisions in this book, they don't rank them in any particular order. Like, this is number one, this is number two. That's hard to do.
That really would be. Based on what? How much money was made off that decision, right, or whether the company's still in business?
Right.
Hard to say.
But these were just great decisions. And that'll be interesting to read that book. I think you're going to read it, Josh.
I think I'd like to. Yeah. That's one of the things about these executive reviews. You say, okay, well, did I learn enough to not read it? Or have you piqued my interest enough that I need now to pick it up?
But we're going to have to find out more about this. But they stand, these decisions, as inspirational examples of something. They inspire us to do what?
To buck conventional wisdom. And this is actually synonymous with counterintuitive, and going against the grain means to oppose or refuse to go along with something. So similar, when you buck conventional wisdom, you just do something that nobody else is doing, and they might think you're a little crazy.
That's right.
That's true. And I think this is it goes against what other people think is the right thing to do. So in making these decisions, it might pay off and it might not pay off. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
time will tell.
Time will tell, right.
And that's what our authors have had the benefit of, is looking back in history and seeing what some of these decisions meant. And I used that term hindsight yesterday, just that the benefit of looking back and seeing the perspective that others didn't have. You mentioned Apple yesterday, Bill. I think even Apple didn't realize how fast the smartphone market would grow. When they launched the iPhone, many people were happy with their flip phones, right?
Right.
We didn't think we needed a computer in our pockets 24 hours a day.
That's true. In fact, Steve Jobs, who was the one that was in charge of it at that time, he'd been away from Apple for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, probably a lot of you started out on Apple computers many, many years ago.
Yep.
And those were the ones that people, you know, used. But they were just the regular ones you put on your desk, right?
That's right. But they were
vastly
inferior to the PC at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, of course, the funny thing is Steve Jobs being fired from the company that he founded. Of course, he was highly successful after that, founding Pixar. And he had plenty of other success. And they Apple went through such a bad period. They had some bad CEOs, and I think they were kind of desperate.
Well,
when
yeah,
they hired
I read about that on the web, and it said that in 1990 they lost $816 million, Bill.
Wow.
So their stock wasn't very popular in 1990.
Makes you wonder how a company can stay in business when you lose that much money.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe they're putting on credit cards. That's how they were operating.
And when he became CEO, he didn't really even believe in the future, right?
He didn't really want to. He was working with Pixar, which is a very good motion picture thing, and he liked that better. But they kind of asked him to come back because he knew some things about their systems that other people didn't know, and kind of persuaded him to come back. But he wasn't really crazy about going back to Apple.
No, he actually accepted mostly cash as his compensation when he could have taken stock.
He didn't even want the stock at that time, you know? But what made Apple really become more famous and popular? Was it their desktop computers?
No, it was the phone. It was certainly the iPod, iPhone,
going back to their music players. Yeah.
But even when they launched the phone, people thought they were crazy and said, what are you doing? You're a computer company. You don't know anything about telecommunications.
Right.
And boy, were they wrong.
Yeah, at that time, you have to consider Nokia controlled 70% of the mobile phone market, and BlackBerry already had smartphones, and they were the leader at that
time. That's true. So. Yeah, well, Jobs got a lot of credit, you know, for things, but he did hire somebody, it says, by the name of Tom Cook, who was an expert at the logistics, and they told him to fire a lot of people. They laid off thousands of people, and they closed factories. That must have been hard to take.
That's right.
And then they decided that they were not going to just make those kind of computers, that they were going to go to iPods and iPads and iPhones, all those kind of things. That was the direction to go.
And people thought they were crazy for creating that closed ecosystem where your music only works on your the devices that Apple makes. People thought it was all about open. Everything has to be open. And he said, no, I don't want Flash on my phones. I don't want MP3s on my phones. I want to control everything. And the detractors were loud, but they were wrong.
Well, and there's also some other examples in this book, too, that people may not be so familiar. Like, for instance, Zappos, which we did an article before last year, which was really interesting, that they offer not only free shipping, but similar to Nordstrom, free returns. So you get these shoes, they don't fit, you can send them back, and Zappos gives your money back, no questions asked.
If you don't know about Zappos, you can do www.zappos.com, and then you can find out. And they have all kinds of shoes, every kind.
And there's also a chapter in the book called Walmart and the 6 a.m. Meeting. And I don't know much about that chapter, but I would not want to attend a 6 a.m. meeting.
Do not show that chapter to Doris, please.
6 a.m. I think that's a good idea, Josh.
I don't want her getting any ideas about any 6 a.m. meetings.
We
need
6 a.m. meetings. That's what we, you know what?
Terrible idea.
Bill, we used to record Studio Classroom at 6 o'clock in the morning because people would come to our offices here, to the studios, before they went to work.
Wow.
And they would record, and I would have coffee and donuts for them, too. That wasn't bad.
Are you going to bring some coffee?
Well,
the donuts part sounds good.
Donuts? That sounds good.
Coffee?
Yeah.
I'm feeling
but,
a
you know,
better
Samsung was also another innovative company, and back in the 1990s, they sent a lot of their brightest employees to other countries to learn the culture and the language and to make connections. In fact, they sent, 4,700 employees all around to 80 different nations.
Mm.
That's pretty bold that Korean company did that, wasn't it?
Yeah, Samsung has grown tremendously, and there's a chapter on them in this book.
Right.
How they describe it. It was a year for them to goof off in the other cultures. And really what they were supposed to do is just learn about the cultures and learn what type of products that these people might like. And because growing up in Korea, it's a fairly closed society.
Right.
So Samsung says we need our people in touch with the international markets.
And I experienced that. We had a Korean ad agency come and send its people to our web design company in the States and just work for us for 6 months for free, just so they could experience what an American web design company would be like.
And after that, they became the world's largest memory chip producer in 1992, and they did the first LCD screen in 1995, and the biggest manufacturer of those panels in 2006. Just think of that.
And their cell phone sales is through the roof. They are the fastest growing mobile device maker in the world.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, HTC and some of these other companies, everybody said you just have to keep making computers, but no, they Cher Wang and them got into making these phones.
Yep, made the
and
change.
And I'll tell you, that makes a big difference. They made it at the right time.
Yeah, it was a good decision. Another one I was reading about here was Toyota. I didn't realize it, but actually Toyota had made cars and exported them to the United States in the 50s, late 50s. And they actually withdrew from the American market in 1961 because it was junk.
Right.
Their cars were just breaking down. They were terrible. And then what they did is they just re-engineered everything, focused on quality, and re-entered the market just at the right time during the oil crisis, the OPEC oil crisis in the early 70s.
And they did something different, too.
Yeah.
They did something different. They said you can order certain things on your car, and then they put it together for you.
Yeah.
So they did a lot of innovative things.
So it's interesting. They took failure, pulled back, and then re-engineered and came back in and, of course, dominated the market.
Well, I'm sure you're going to find a lot of interesting things in this book, and it's been good to talk about them, but don't be afraid to be creative. I don't know if you're going to get $100 million to do whatever you want to do, but whatever you do, when you make bold decisions, think of new ways to do things. And that's always, there's a need for new ways to do a lot of things. There's a lot of things to invent still. So thanks for being with us as we discuss this.
Yeah, and come on back next time, and I hope our listeners learn from this. Don't just always go with the flow. Be a little counterintuitive. You don't know what you might find.
That's right. It was a great program. Thanks for joining us.
So we'll see you for a new lesson tomorrow. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.